And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Well, hello, it's Martin Willis, and welcome to the show. I'm your host, and we have a great one for you this evening. I have good news and bad news for the people over on YouTube. The bad news I'll start out with is that this is not a live show. Excuse me. It's being streamed, but at the regular time, but it is not a live show. It's pre-recorded. And the good news is, maybe good news to some of you anyway, that I will be active in the chat room during the show. So fire away and just be kind. That's all. So the guest today is Anthony LaPay, and he is a New York-based showrunner, director, investigative journalist. We're going to be talking tonight about Unidentified Inside America's UFO Investigation, which is coming out really soon on Friday, May 31st. That's 10 to 9 Central Time on the History Channel. And I'm really excited about that. I was lucky enough to be able to watch the screener. I'll talk a little bit about that later. Second part of the show. Well, this is for the first segment. I have Anthony. And the last two segments of the show, I have MJ Benias. He's a repeat guest. He's going to be talking about his new book that has just come out. He's always a lot of fun, entertaining and all. So I do want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. And anyone can do that. Go over to podcastufo.com. You can see the information there. Our blog this week is titled UFOs and Money. And that's by Charles Lear. And that's basically about the money and the concepts of money that is made in this kind of, fringe, you may say, industry of UFOs. So it's very interesting. Great read. Check that out. All right. So we are ready to start with our guest. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thanks, Martin, for having me on.
Yes. Yeah. I'm real, real excited about your upcoming series. Is this your brainchild or partially your brainchild?
No, I'm an independent filmmaker and television producer, and History Channel had been talking with Lou Elizondo and Tom DeLonge and Chris Mellon for a little while after the big New York Times article came out in October of 2017, and they were just very excited about trying to figure out a way to do a show with them, and they brought me on in the spring of last year. Basically, we had exclusive access to everything that they were doing over this past year.
Wow, that just alone is fascinating to be able to get kind of some insight that a lot of people in the UFO community, of course, are just trying to get all the information possible. It's very hard, and they're playing it close to the vest, and I understand why things can get carried away or misconstrued. So anyway, it must have been a fascinating journey since then.
It has to have probably been the most fascinating, mind-blowing project I've ever worked on. It was absolutely really incredibly just, these guys are just such interesting people with their each individual backgrounds. As you know, there's such a mix of characters involved in the To the Stars group. You know, we have Tom DeLonge, who's this rock star, super passionate about this issue, was able to wrangle all these guys together. You have Lou Elizondo, a guy who, you know, really worked in the shadows in some of the most sensitive counterintelligence operations that the U.S. military was conducting around the world. And then you have a guy like Chris Mellon, who's a old school intelligence, old hand, as that you could say, who, as Lou says, is a guy who knew all the secrets. This was a guy who was overseeing budgets for special access programs that of just super, super high level of classification. So, and that's not even, and not to forget Steve Justice, you know, from Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. So it just an incredible, you know, incredibly high level group of individuals, and just great guys. So being able to have a front row seat to sort of a year in their life after this big New York Times article broke and they were, you know, involved in getting those three videos released from the DOD, it's just been, it's just absolutely fascinating.
Right, right. Chris was a former guest on this show. I was thrilled to have him on. And I'm really glad, you know, he is, you know, keeping with his interest on this subject. And that's what I say about everyone that's involved with that. Actually, you know, these are people that are out on a limb, actually, because of
absolutely,
you know, the factor of the
absolutely.
Yeah. So it's, we're real. I don't want to speak for everyone, but I can speak for myself that I'm thrilled that they're taking the chance and trying to move the ball forward, whatever the ball is. You know, it's so hard to know what these things are. And I'm just willing to bet that you probably don't know any more than you did of what they are.
I definitely have many more questions than I have answers. Mm-hmm. But what we really try to do, and I think as hopefully if you saw when you were able to get watch the first episode of our 6-part series, is what we're trying to do here is to kind of, in some ways, reinvent the genre of UFO television, where so many of the shows are coming in with a preconceived notion of what these things are, that they're somehow extraterrestrial, and they kind of back into and try to kind of leave out countervailing information, etc. What we try to do is really just take a very cold look at what these military witnesses are seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone is going to blow your mind, because, and I think what's so fascinating is what we see that's just happened in April with the Navy coming out and announcing that they have new guidelines for pilots and others to report UFO encounters. But really what that is, you know, that's one part of what that means. But really what that is a tacit admission that what these pilots are seeing are not U.S. military. So once you knock out that that these are, you know, not U.S. military craft intercepting our own jets, you're left with, you know, only one other plausible explanation, and that is a foreign adversary, or maybe an ally, but more likely an adversary. So, but as we really delve into on the series, that explanation is for anyone who knows anything about propulsion and about the recent advancements in aircraft and where the Russians are and the Chinese are, it's very hard to square that circle.
Mm-hmm.
So so what we really do is look at all those different test cases and try to talk about them in a very investigative way, and really just hear directly from the pilots and the radar technicians and operators and others who are witnessing these things, and really let people you know, make up their own mind about what they could be.
Yeah, that's an excellent approach, I believe. You know, we've said many times in the show, if someone tells you they know what it is, then run away. Because I don't think, you know, I don't know if we'll ever know, but I really don't, you know, as far as, you know, all the conspiracies and that are out there, you know, that the government knows and hiding it from us, I truly think they probably don't really know. They may know more, because a lot of things, it's, you know, it's, they've definitely hidden away a lot of things, you know, over the years, save footage and, you know, you name it, told witnesses, military witnesses, you know, to made them sign non-disclosures and all that. And so there's been a lot of cover up, but I don't think it's cover up because they know what it is. I think, you know, there's the cover-up is more inclined by the fact that they don't know what it is. And, you know, for the Air Force to actually not be able to protect our skies and us to know that would be pretty scary.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think a big thing it actually only reinforced something that I've always said. I'm someone who I've reported on the government for many years, and in particular law enforcement and intelligence agencies. And I think a big thing for people to understand out there is no such thing as the U.S. government. There's just in the intelligence world, there's 17 different intelligence agencies, right? There's five different branches of the military. So, to say that anyone that there is anything like the U.S. government or they know, there is no, it's very difficult to pinpoint. But I do think what we're seeing with this new Navy announcement is at least as far as the U.S. Navy goes, they don't have answers at hand. And that's the significance of really these two major pillars in the whole story of UFOs that have happened over the last year and a half, beginning with the release of the three videos in 2017 into 2018, and then this announcement by the Navy that their recent events that are happening that they can't explain, and that they want to create a policy that encourages pilots to report them, because that's a big thing that many of the pilots we talk to, and there's many more pilots. One of the interesting things when you watch our series, you're going to meet and see several pilots, including the pilots who were involved in the other two videos that were released by the DOD. And we're going to shed some new light on that incident or incidents, if you will. But a lot of those, but there's many more pilots that I talked to who didn't want to go on air, who confirmed their stories. But one of the things that really struck me was David Fravor's wingman pilot, who spoke to us for the first time, was a female pilot, as you see in the first episode. Mm-hmm. One of the things that she told us, and I'm sorry, I can't remember if this is in the episode. It might be in the following episode where we kind of circle back to her. One of the things she said to us is, if I was alone and it was a single seat pilot and I was just out on a patrol or something, and I saw this, I probably wouldn't have told anyone.
Right.
The only reason that they came back and said what had happened was because all four of them saw it, the two pilots and their weapon systems operators. That was a big thing that is the reason why this wingman pilot and David Fravor are coming forward, is because they want it to be okay to report that. You know, I mean, this was an incident that happened in broad daylight. I mean, that's the other thing that I think is a huge difference for me in the sort of veracity of these stories. These are pilots intercepting things in broad daylight, seeing things. So many things can happen at night, whether that's a weather inversion or, you know, reflections or all the other weird things that happen at night. But when you're seeing things up close and personal, during broad daylight on a perfectly clear day over the Pacific, and it's being confirmed by all these different pilots. And here's the other thing that I'm going to tell you that we do in this show, which I can't tell you. I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but we find many civilian witnesses in the same area where the Nimitz incident occurred, who tell of ongoing incidents, very similar to the Nimitz incident.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that I've always thought as I've looked at this subject over the years is that it is so strange that there's reoccurring what they call flaps or whatever. It just makes you wonder why they're in one area. You know, it's a big world to explore.
Yes, that is one of the topics that we actually get into. It's a really good point. That is one of the questions that we ask, because we clearly are seeing that there are some sort of, you know, what they call hotspots for these incidents that are happening in certain parts of the world. And even in, as I believe you see in episode one, ATIP even created a map in 2009 that we reveal that shows some of just a very small smattering of plot points on a global map where the military had reported seeing incidents. So that is one of the enduring mysteries of this whole thing, which is fascinating. And we delve into that question. Again, probably raising more questions than we have answers, but we definitely are, this show, I hope, will push the needle forward in this conversation, because primarily, and that's what this was, obviously a strategic decision by Elizondo, but also us as filmmakers making this series, was by focusing on these military witnesses, several of which are active duty people who have everything to lose. You know, when you're an F-18 pilot, it's very easy to be grounded. You can one slip up and you can basically lose your, you know, have your driver's license taken away, for lack of a better word. So these guys, you know, these guys are the creme de la creme of the military. To be an F-18 pilot in the Navy is a dream of thousands of pilots that go in. Even just to be a C-130 pilot is a dream for, you know. But to be a fighter pilot in the Navy flying an F-18, is, you've really reached the pinnacle. So to risk that by coming forward and talking about something that potentially could brand you as, you know, some kind of put you in the, you know, in some sort of psych, you know, of eval situation, it's just an incredibly brave thing for people, for someone to do. As I said, I talked to many more pilots than you see in the show who spoke to me off the record confirming the larger details of this other main incident that we look into, but those guys did not want to go on camera. And listen, I can't blame them. You know, if you worked all your life and you had a dream of becoming a fighter pilot and you want to serve your country, it's a very risky thing. So what is interesting now is the Navy is saying, hey, you don't have to be afraid anymore. What we're hoping is when our show goes on the air, we actually have at the end of every episode an email address for military witnesses to contact us.
Wow.
Because we want to continue this investigation, because as I said, even though we have a ton of new and really fascinating information that you're going to see in this series, we've, as you know, we've touched the tip of the iceberg. There is this is an ongoing situation. These events are happening all over the world. They're happening all the time. They may be increasing. We don't know that for sure. But there are people who say they are. So what is happening is it's exciting, and I think George Knapp said it best. He said it's exciting and it's a little scary.
Yeah, and I love the military cases. We've had a number of military people, including Nimitz witnesses on the show in the past. That is such an amazing case. And of course, I've tried to get David Fravor on, but he's getting, you know, he wants to be careful where he goes and as far as any public appearances, things like that. So I understand, you know, eventually maybe I'll get him on the show, but it was, I love the fact that he explains what he did, how he did. He was also on a Fighter Pilots podcast and talked about it. And that was a really great show to listen to from the perspective of a fighter pilot.
We brought along Commander Fravor to meet another pilot from another incident. And you'll see him, Lou Elizondo, and this new pilot that no one's heard from before talk about another incident. And we wanted to bring Fravor along, both to help this pilot feel comfortable in knowing that, you know, Fravor's career wasn't harmed by coming out, and he still, you know, works in the private sector now, but still, you know, is a respected person in the military community. But also what was fascinating is just to hear them talk about the aeronautics and all the physics about what this guy saw, and compare and contrast the craft that he was seeing with what Fravor saw. And it was just absolutely fascinating, because these guys are really, really, I mean, that's the other thing about F-18 pilots. I can't overemphasize how smart these guys are, at least when it comes to aviation, physics of flight, lift, propulsion, all those things. I mean, they are extremely knowledgeable about the physics of flight and what's possible. And they're also trained, as you know, to see into to what is a foreign adversary, what is a profile of a, what are all the known threats in the air that they need to look out for? What's a red threat? What's a blue friendly? Right. So to hear these two pilots talk was absolutely fascinating. So I think viewers are really going to be that's in episode 4. That people are going to be fascinated to see this conversation between these two fighter pilots.
That's great. Now, did you have an interest in the subject prior to taking this project on?
You know, that's a great question. I had run for years a website called the Guerrilla News Network, which is an independent news site. And we had covered the Disclosure Project's original press conference and some of the reports that they were putting out back, I don't know, in the early aughts, right? So it was always something that I had been interested in, but had read up a decent amount, but was by no means an expert, and really had no opinion either way, other than being really intrigued by what was always most fascinating to me, and we bring this up and I integrate some of this into the show, is really looking at the historical record and how these things appear to been happening for at least 7 decades. And to be so documented and to be documented all over the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what always fascinated me was, you know, because I do know a little bit about sort of advanced weapons testing and things like that and secret programs and the idea that somehow these could be chalked up as just some kind of advanced weapons test when we were building the stealth bomber. I mean, there was, you know, I think Brian Bender from Politico put it to me. He said, you know, those were built in onesies and twosies. There's not fleets of these things flying over Argentina and over, and if they were, why are they being seen over Russia? Why are they being seen over Chile if it's an advanced, you know, that's why they have Groom Lake, is to fly them in controlled airspaces. Right. So all those things never really added up to me. And I'm a person who I'm highly skeptical of any source, but I also believe fundamentally that people do not put themselves out in positions that can harm their reputation without a good reason. Mm-hmm. And so many of these, there's so many reports, obviously, that are people who are, you know, unstable or who have, you know, who are seeing things that they're getting confused. But there's so many more reports over the years from UFO, just everyday people seeing UFOs, where clearly these are people, you know, for instance, law enforcement officers who are out on the road all the time, and sheriffs. And we actually have a military veteran that we interview who was a sheriff for 7 years of a county in the Midwest. I mean, these are people who have no reason to be coming out and saying and writing up reports and filing them to their, you know, about things. So I've always been a populist in that sense of that I do fundamentally believe that most people are telling the truth, even though maybe they're deluded, you know, about what they're seeing or confused or something, that most people are not just, you know, coming up and making up stories to make a buck. Obviously that happens in this world because there is, you know, as you mentioned, you're going to be talking about that later on the show. Obviously there are people or hucksters who are taking advantage of people's fascination with this issue. But that's what's always struck me about this issue is that, you know, who wants to come out and brand themselves? I mean, I had I'm in a very nervous time in my life waiting for this show to air and how it's going to reflect on my credibility as a journalist. It's a risky, it's a third rail thing to touch, you know? So I have a lot of apprehension myself, even though we're double checking and triple checking everything we can, you know.
Well, I got to tell you, relax, because after watching the screener, and I've said this on another show I was on, that it's the best thing I've seen on TV in regarding this topic. And I can't wait to be able to watch the rest of the series. It's a 6-part series. And limited series, Unidentified, Inside America's UFO Investigation. Don't forget, it premieres on Friday, May 31st at 10, that's 9 Central Time on the History Channel. Anthony, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure, and I really appreciate that you came on the show.
Thank you. Keep up this great work. It's such a great podcast, and it's really appreciated. And thank you for your kind words about the show.
Well, it's all true. All right, everyone, hang in for these messages. We'll be right back with MJ Banias. All right, welcome back. And like I said, my guest is MJ Banias. He's the author of The UFO People, A Curious Culture. And I can't wait to talk to him about that. He's an educator, writer, and blogger. He does some blogging for Mysterious Universe and Rogue Planet. And he has been included in the Fortean Times, Fate Magazine. And he also has a book entitled UFOs Reframing the Debate. I remember I had talked to him about that one. And he lives in Canada. He's got 2 children and a massive cat. I love that about him. How you doing? Welcome to the show, MJ.
Oh, Martin, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I was just looking. I think it's been over a year since you've been on previously.
Yeah, it probably has been. It has been a while, so I'm really excited to be back on your show and to be chatting with you again. Though we do chat sort of off and on, sort of casually every once in a while. Yeah,
throw each other an email or a text, or with so many ways to communicate one way or another. We always seem to here and there about different things. So
I always get led back to you for some reason. Doesn't matter. All the weird UFO drama in my life always tends to come back to you, Martin.
I wish you were the only one that said that.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But anyway, so for the person, I say this every show now because I get a lot of email. I have a bunch of new listeners. A lot of people that are actually new to the UFO topic will come and listen to the show, and I really do appreciate that. And so a lot of times when I'm talking about a UFO event, a sighting, that famous sighting or something like that, I forget that. And I do want to apologize to them because I don't really explain the detail of a lot of things. But anyway, speaking of detail, can you give more of a detailed background and what sparked your interest in this subject?
Sure, yeah. I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. When I was a kid, my parents made very questionable choices about my television consumption. So I watched a lot of TV that was inappropriate for a young mind, such as, you know, The X-Files and The Outer Limits and Twilight Zone and all the weird stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Star Trek, which is, that's okay. Anyway, I always had an interest in the weird and the science fiction and ghosts and the paranormal. And then it wasn't really until university that I got into the more academic study of culture and theory and philosophy. And sort of I met various individuals in a paranormal group, and then Chris Rutkowski, who's a local UFO writer in my city. And we sort of became fast friends. He sort of said, you know, you should look at this UFO thing a little more. He kind of shoved me into this world of UFOs. And I've been hooked ever since. Studying sort of the UFO discourse and the narrative and the phenomenon has been sort of very interesting for me. I became a MUFON field investigator for a few years just to kind of get my feet wet and really kind of see how UFO investigation works. Got into some research, started a blog, Terra Obscura, which has been amazing. And it's sort of culminated into a book, which you mentioned in the intro. And here I am. I don't know. It's been five, six years, in this UFO world. And it's been a blast. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I say the same thing, you know, just the people that I've met along the way, you know, is really actually, you know, it might sound corny, but it's really enriched my life. I really felt, things are, you know, my life is better, just through all the interesting people I've met. It's a great mystery that we're all looking at. And there's a lot of really intelligent people trying to figure this thing out, whatever it is. And it makes it very rewarding. I really enjoy it a lot. And that's, it's been, wow, it's going to be 8 years coming up in this November. So I'm pretty happy about that.
Yeah.
Well, I've been doing the show, yeah.
Yeah, your show, I mean, I guess your show is... It's like a movement, you know what I mean? I find, like, you know, when I first got into UFOs, I had nowhere to go. And I be honest, the podcast UFO was one of the first ones I found on, like, my Apple thing. And, I've been listening to it and keeping track and just kind of popping on every once in a while and listening to, you know, a bunch of episodes and then coming back a few months later, listening to a bunch of episodes because, you know, my drives to work, right? Catching up on all your episodes. So I've been honest, for all of the new people out in the UFO world, podcast UFO is a good place to be because it's a good, sensical and sensible look at UFOs. It's not sort of crazy talk, which is nice.
Well, thank you. Crazy talk does well, though. I mean, it's very popular, unfortunately. Yeah. But anyway, I do appreciate that a lot. And, you know, I did pick that name. I know I had spoken to someone, a web person, and I said, I want to do a podcast on UFOs. What's the best way to get the best traffic? And he said, name it UFO podcast, I guess. The URL was not available, so podcast UFO was.
Yeah.
And that's how I named the show. It's pretty funny. But you found it right away, and it does get a lot of traffic. So,
You punch in UFO. It's like the first thing that pops up.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. So it worked. So your blog, your website, how long ago did you start that?
It would have been, well, I think I've been running it now for about five years. I've been writing that. I think so. It would have been 20. I don't know what would have been. What year is it now? 2019. So it would have been 2015-ish, I guess, or 2016. I would have started doing blog posts and doing more research into that. Maybe longer. I'll be honest. Like the time is so weird, right? You forget. Something that happened a year ago feels like it happened a few weeks ago. So yeah, I think 2015, 2016 is when my blog start. No, 2015 is when my blog started. And that's really when my research began for the book. I had no idea I was writing a book at that point. That's usually how it works, right?
Yeah.
It's been 5 years now, I think, which has been crazy. I joined MUFON shortly after that. And that was 2016. I joined MUFON and became a field investigator, and I did that for a couple years. So I left. Nope, I'm telling a lie. I must have joined MUFON in 2015. And I did 2.5 years or roughly 3 years of investigations. And then I left due to sort of political reasons. I think we all remember that sort of dark, weird road MUFON went down there for a bit with some of its, with its state director, of its state directors, rather. So I left because of that.
A little bit of an exodus.
I think so. I think a lot of people kind of felt that move. But it's interesting because I wrote a book about the UFO subculture and the community of people. So it's interesting that this acted almost as a catalyst for some people to sort of say, you know what, I can't be with this organization anymore due to political reasons. And it only kind of goes to show that the UFO phenomenon and the UFO discourse and the people who engage in UFO conversations sort of are political people. There's a lot of politics involved in the study of UFOs. So, and race politics is one of them, that's for sure. And case in point, right, when that whole event occurred, you had a lot of people just simply say, I can't be involved anymore because of, you know, the way this was handled. And yeah, it's a shame that it happened, but you know, it is what it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's been a few other things happening, with MUFON in the last few months. I'm sure you've noticed that too, or saw that. And some people say, oh, it's just a disgruntled administrator, but there may be more to it. I don't know. I really don't like to get involved too much in the negative side of things going on in the politics of UFOs, but it's there. I do want to tell the listener something. I watch your YouTube channel, and it's just your name, basically, right, to get to the channel?
Yeah, just punch it in.
MJ Banias, and I got to tell you, it is very, very entertaining. You are great. You do such a wonderful job in that, and you review books, you review all kinds of things. You want to talk a little bit about that and
sure,
how that's going? And by the way, I really encourage any listener to check that out. It's a blast. I look forward to each one of those shows.
Oh, well, then I'll, thanks for the plug. That's really nice of you. So my YouTube channel is YouTube, www.youtube.com/MJBanias. Just punch in my name. And it's a relatively new thing. It started a few months ago. The idea was to take my blog, Terra Obscura, and kind of move it over, and provide some video content. Because I think sometimes my blog, I'm one of those people that I tell myself I'm going to write an 800 word post, and then it ends up being 2,500 words, and it's incredibly long and convoluted. So I think a lot of my readers were getting just a little frustrated with the fact that, you know, my content wasn't, you know, you kind of read it and go. It's you need to dedicate, you know, an evening to kind of reading it. So it was sort of pitched to me, this idea that, you know, maybe you should take some of your content from your blog and tweak it and just bring it into sort of YouTube, and make it a little more accessible and make it more digestible in like a 5 to 10 to 15 minute kind of just go, hear the points. So I decided to do it. Twice a week I release new videos. So every Tuesday, I release a pre-recorded video. So it'll be usually a review of a documentary or, a book all related to the paranormal or UFOs. Or I'll release, just a sort of a random video. My last one that just came out was, three secrets of all UFO investigators, sort of the three secrets that UFO investigators don't necessarily want you to know, or the three things you kind of need to know if you ever want to get into UFO investigation. So I have videos like that, and it basically talks about sort of the implications and the cultural issues and the social issues that arise and the political issues that arise in ufology. So that's every Tuesday. And then every Thursday I have a little live show I do called Cafe Obscura, where I just interview some of the movers and the shakers in the paranormal world. And I've had amazing guests, Mark O'Connell, who wrote The Close Encounters Man, Dr. Gary Nolan, who from Stanford University. I've interviewed Ryan Sprague, a friend of ours. I've interviewed, Seth Breedlove's coming up from Small Town Monsters, Allison Jornlin, Eric Luke. So I've interviewed a bunch of people. So, you know, if you want to check that out, they're all available on my channel as well. So, like I said, it's been kind of a fun process, but it seems to be doing well. I have about 700 subscribers, which is not a lot, I understand. But it's been a few months and it's growing steadily. So, if you're interested, click subscribe, as they always say, right?
Yeah.
Down below.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it takes a long time to, this channel's been up for 4 years. It takes a long time to build up, you know, an audience, and you just keep what you're doing because what you're doing is really good, and you will watch that. It will grow. I guarantee that. And the only magic is to just keep doing it on a regular basis and doing what you do, such a great job that you do.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. So I'm trying to remember what your first book, can you kind of talk about that a little bit, what your first book was? And then, well, of course, we're going to talk about your latest book, but just a quick overall for the person that missed your show, you know, over a year ago, if you would.
Sure. So I was involved in a project. Actually, I was one of the writers it was a sort of a collection of works called UFOs, Reframing the Debate. So Robbie Graham, who is he's an author as well, he put together a collection of different UFO writers and researchers, and we all contributed a chapter to this collection. And the best way to explain UFOs, Reframing the Debate is... I think the best way is worded right on the back of the book. It's a cold, hard slap to the face of ufology. And it's kind of looking at the phenomenon and the people and the conversation about UFOs in a different way. So examining it from different angles, talking about some of the more maybe cultural or political aspects of the phenomenon, starting to move away from a lot of the ideology that exists. So, you know, believing in aliens or believing in reptilians and blue avians or whatever, you know, starting to kind of deconstruct those beliefs and really questioning why we believe those things and moving on to sort of where ufology needs to go. So that was sort of the purpose of that book. And my particular chapter had to do with economics and what would happen to like our economic systems if it was proven that there was some sort of intelligent other out there, not necessarily aliens, but what if there was some other intelligence? Would we see a sort of shaking down of our political and economic systems? What would happen to our society and our culture if it turned out that, you know, there was some sort of intelligence out there using UFOs or flying UFOs or whatever in our skies? So that was the first book or the first sort of big project that I was involved in. With Robbie Graham and Reframing the Debate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, we'll talk about your latest book, of course. But I do want to talk about the last segment that was before you. I had the same person you interviewed, Anthony Lepe. Mm-hmm. I really don't know if I pronounced that correctly.
I feel like it is. I feel like that's right. Okay, yeah.
So anyway, I know that you have watched the same thing that I watched, and I just wanted to get your feedback. I thought it was great, and of course I mentioned that in the first part of the show, and I wanted to hear what you thought overall of that.
We're talking about Unidentified, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, well, of course we will give no spoilers to the listener because it's coming out, and you know, real soon.
Yeah, that's thanks for reminding me, because I would have just started like, this is what happens.
Yeah,
it's like Game of Thrones, right? You can't go on Facebook without seeing what happened. Yeah. And I haven't seen it yet, so let's just be cool.
Yeah.
So
they're all dead. Yeah.
Oh God, damn it.
Not really.
No. Yeah. So Unidentified was very well done. I had the opportunity to interview Anthony LaPay myself a few days ago, actually over the phone. I'm writing an article about the TV show for Mysterious Universe. I'm doing a sort of first look and review. So he sat down with me for about 20 minutes on the phone. And I have to be honest, I thought the episode itself was great, but talking to him, and I'm sure, like, you know, your previous segment with him, you know, you get such a better understanding of the behind the scenes stuff that built that show. You know, they mention it once in the episode itself, but you find out, and Anthony probably, you know, talks about this, you find out, like, they were with them for a year, following them around, sort of doing the work for this program. So it's been a year in production almost. And the detail and the information they provide is awesome. And the show isn't a typical UFO show.
Right.
Like they don't say the word alien once in the first episode. They might kind of mention it in further episodes, or someone else will mention it, like a witness or whatever. But it's like the word alien like really never comes up, which is really refreshing. They don't talk about extraterrestrials. They don't talk about interdimensional beings. They don't talk about anything like that. They just simply talk about UFOs as we ought to talk about them. It's a sort of, you know, UFOs exist, but we don't know anything about them apart from the fact that they behave in ways that, you know, sort of violate our current understanding of how things ought to move in the air or in the water or in space, I suppose. So it's such a good show because it's so grounded. It's not going down weird roads, and you're not talking about really, like, you're not talking about alien human hybrids or anything, you know what I mean? Like, there's no reptilians mentioned. It's wonderful. You know, like, yeah. It's just sort of a down to earth show that's very journalistic in nature, which is why I really enjoyed it. I'm really looking forward to all six episodes. Just to kind of see where they go with this.
I really hope they expose the fact that reptilians are among us, you know. Eventually they should come out with that. Yeah.
Well, yeah. They live in Antarctica, right? Don't they? Isn't that where all
Yeah,
all
of course. Yeah. And with Hitler's secret base up there, he's still alive. Right. Yeah.
That's right.
That's all good. Yeah. Yeah. So what is it like in Canada as far as, I mean, we never really talked about that before. You know, I know Chris, I've talked to him a few times, met him out at a conference, and great guy, does a really nice job. What do you keep? You said you were involved in MUFON. What are the sightings like in your? I don't know exactly where you are in Canada, but what are the sightings like? Or are there any historic cases anywhere near you that you've looked into?
Yeah, I live in Winnipeg, in the same city Chris does, so right smack dab in the middle of the continent. So I would say our landmark case in at least near me is the Falcon Lake UFO encounter, which was with Mihalik, and he was a prospector, an amateur prospector who was out in Falcon Lake, which is a sort of it's sort of like a resort kind of beach area, I guess you could say. It's like a provincial, or I guess it's a federal. It's a federal park here. It's massive, like thousands and thousands and thousands of acres, and it sits on Falcon Lake on the coast. So on this massive lake, and it's about an hour and a half from where we live. And he was out, it was 1967 summer. I can't remember if it was, no, it was actually this, it was May. It just, the anniversary just happened. It was, May 20th or 21st. He was out prospecting, and this strange sort of object descends, down in front of him, this sort of saucer like craft, and this open door. And he thinks it's some, you know, strange American, you know, aircraft or something. So he goes in and he yells inside, you know, asks, and he literally says, you know, hey, Yanks, do you need any help or something to that effect? And then the most famous part of the case is this thing suddenly kind of turns, and he gets blasted with this hot gas that emits out the side of this UFO, and then it takes off. And he has these burn marks. And if you Google the Falcon Lake UFO case, you'll see a picture of him in a hospital with these odd burn marks. They're these sort of spots, right? In this grid shape.
Like, and he says it was like he was grilled almost.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Except it was, there were circles. So they're not sort of like almost like grill lines. They're these odd round dots, and they're in a perfect sort of pattern. And anyway, the reason why this case, the Falcon Lake case, is so great, and I've done one of my actually YouTube episodes was reviewing the book Chris wrote. But it's such a good case because there's so much documentation for it. There's more documentation for this case than there is for Roswell, for example. You know, the Roswell case is a landmark case in ufology, but the vast majority of the paperwork for that case comes from sort of secondhand witnesses or people who heard stuff. So you have reams and reams of documentation for Roswell, but really primary documentation, there's very little, if anything. Whereas in this case, Blue Book investigated it. Mihalyk got so sick that he had to go to the Mayo Clinic in Minneapolis, and the doctors there had no idea what was wrong with him. They basically said he got burned. He had radiation burns, and he was suffering from radiation sickness and poisoning. But, you know, how does a prospector out in the middle of nowhere suddenly get exposed to that much radiation to the point where it burns him and he gets sort of repeatedly ill? Chris has a piece of silver that was melted onto sort of this rock that this thing landed in kind of between a crevice, and it's highly radioactive even to this day.
Wow.
He keeps it in his office in these sort of glass containers, and he says they're protecting him from the radiation, but I have to be honest, every time I meet him, he seems a little crazier. So maybe it's kind of...
Well, I think you need lead for that, don't you?
Rotting his brain, yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's interesting because we were talking in his office, and it's on YouTube where he pulls this thing out, and he says, oh, here you go, you should check this out, and he hands me this piece of metal. I'm like, oh, what's this? And he's like, oh, it's a piece of silver from a... that melted from a UFO, and it's highly radioactive. And I mean, I'm just like, well, I guess I'm not having kids anymore. That's it. It's over, you know? But it's such a great case, because you had the police investigate it. You had Air Force, you had military, various government agencies. We have testing results from a lot of the equipment he was wearing that got burned. So, you know, it's such a landmark case, at least for us here, And yet a lot of people have never heard of it, but it's incredibly compelling. It's more compelling than Roswell, in my opinion, because of the documentation. And because ultimately documents don't lie, right? The mm-hmm. Mayo Clinic paperwork that this guy had after he got sick is not telling any lies, right? The doctors say this is what he had, and that's what he had. So it's an amazing case, but that would be hours for sure.
Wow. Now, we just got like a minute and a half here before we go to break, but did people try to consider that, you know, debunkers say that was a hoax, and if so, what did they say they thought happened?
Yeah, the common one was he burned himself on a barbecue. That was the common, right? He like purposefully either got, well, he got drunk and he fell on a barbecue, or he took like a grill and he burned himself purposefully with it. Or he burned himself accidentally and then turned it into something that it wasn't.
Wow.
Yeah. The problem is, you know, burning yourself on a barbecue isn't going to lead to you getting radiation sickness to the point where the Mayo Clinic says, yeah, no, you have like radiation sickness.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how the skeptics and the debunkers kind of got away with that one, but yeah.
Yeah. That's a pretty funny one actually. But interesting. So, and did he live for a long time after that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did. He lived for I think another 20 or 30 years or so. I mean, he lived well into his 80s. But he got recurringly ill. So those scars and those burns would resurface every few years. So he would get this big inflamed mark where he got burned on his side. And he would become quite ill for several weeks, and then it would go away, and then he would be fine for a year or two, and then it would flare up again. And again, that's all documented. So, you know, we have the paperwork on that too. So that was a pretty bad barbecue burn, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, it's time for us to go to break. So hang in there, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages. All right, welcome back. My guest, my second guest this evening is MJ Benias. Thanks for joining us. And so we were talking about the poor guy with the that laid down face first on the barbecue grill. I didn't realize those were actually circular. That makes it even stranger. You know, I have seen the pictures, the black and white pictures of him, you know, with those burns. But you know, we right before we went to break, we were talking about the debunkers and what they said, you know, their excuse or whatever. But what about the people that, you know, really believe something was going on? You said that Chris had something from the site itself. So people were, and it was investigated by Project Blue Book. What about any Canadian organizations as far as investigating. Do you know anything about that?
Well, listen, at the time, Canada did not have any formal UFO investigative bodies. So we do know that the Canadian Air Force did investigate. We know that Transport Canada did investigate. But again, as well as the RCMP, which is sort of equivalent to the FBI. Mm-hmm. So we do know that the Canadian government did have sort of multiple agencies look at this case, but a lot of them made, you know, the similar conclusions that it was nothing. You know, he got drunk and burned himself. It became problematic because when the Air Force did come to investigate, it was about a year after the event. And he couldn't remember exactly where it all occurred. So he sort of took these Air Force guys on a bit of a, you know, I don't want to use the term wild goose chase, but he was trying to get back to the site. But we need to understand there's no roads to this site. This is, you're in the backwoods of the forests of Canada. Like, you're deep in the middle of nowhere. Even today, the only way to get to that site is by horseback in the summertime, because there's no roads that go there. And in the wintertime, you have to take a snowmobile or a skidoo. So really, it's quite a remote location. And the only thing that stands there even right now is there's a little plaque that stands there right now that they put up. But ultimately, in 1967 and 1968, the year after, trying to find out where he was, he couldn't exactly remember. Now, he eventually did. I think it was a few months later, it came back to him, and he suddenly kind of had the realization, I know where this was, and he did go back out with sort of other government agencies. But, you know, they kind of viewed that as being suspicious, but they did go back and they did find the sort of rock mount where this thing landed and where he sort of encountered it, as well as these radioactive pieces of sort of molten silver that were sort of left behind. Now, we're not thinking that they fell off the UFO, but it was sort of the silver that was in the rock that he was prospecting had melted and then kind of got into this weird crevice of this rock and kind of kept that shape as it cooled off. But they were able to pry it out, and sure enough, you know, it resides here in Winnipeg in the office of Chris Rutkowski, this highly radioactive piece of melted silver. And in one of my videos, like I said, I sort of hold it up to the camera so you can kind of see this odd shape. And you can really sort of just pause and look at the thing. It's quite an odd looking piece of molten metal. But the Canadian organizations kind of as well wrote it off. I think it was kind of in everybody's best interest in 1967, 1968, 1969, that sort of end of Blue Book era, to make these things go away. We don't necessarily want to talk about them, and we don't want to talk about them in any way that gives them legitimacy. And you know, all they simply do is they just simply ignore the vast majority of evidence, right? You don't look at what the doctor said at the Mayo Clinic. You don't look what the doctor said here. And you just simply say, you know, it's something else. It's not related. And that's it. Because I think we have to remember, Blue Book had little interest in actually investigating UFOs, really. It was its purpose, but its purpose was to make them go away.
Right.
So, yeah. No one's going to give this case a fair shake, at least back then.
Right. Now, what about Wilbert Smith? I've heard that name many times up in Canada. Was he active about that time?
You know, I'm not sure. My historical knowledge of Canadian ufology is not very good. The name does sound familiar, mm-hmm. And I'm sure Chris is going to give me hell for not, you know.
I'll make sure he knows.
Anything.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm not the one to ask about Wilbert Smith at this point, unfortunately. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think of a couple of things. You know, when I think of Canada, and one of them is himself. And then there's, I'm going to mess up his name, Paul, Helgert? No, I'm not thinking of.
Hellier?
Yeah.
Hellier?
Yeah, Hellier, yeah.
The former defense minister, yeah.
He's been a little controversial over the years. Interesting guy, though.
You can say that. Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, he was the minister of defense for our nation. So, you know, he deserves all that credit and all that respect. But he has said a lot of things that, you know, you kind of need to take pause. You know, I remember he spoke at a conference and he basically said that people at the conference were aliens in disguise, and he, you know, addressed them in the audience, you know, and you kind of need to sit there and say, like, okay, well, we should just take that for what it is, and move on. Because yeah, he is quite controversial. I think to a lot of people in ufology, he's quite controversial because he has stated a few things that you can't really prove and he can't really prove. So apparently a lot of the people who attend his conferences are aliens in disguise, and they just want to keep him, you know, under surveillance.
Well, you know, as long as they pay for the entrance fee, you know.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the problem is they're aliens, yeah. Right? So they probably don't.
Yeah. Those. Well, that's true. And, you know, my blog this week I mentioned earlier is basically UFOs and money. And basically what that blog is about, the blogger Charles Lear does a lot of research into, you know, how people make or do not make money in the UFO field. And one of them is, you know, the conferences and what it takes to put on a conference. It takes a lot of money and a lot of courage to put on one of those conferences because people can lose money easily and fast.
Well, I think when you look at the successful conferences, right, you need to put bums in seats.
Right.
And ultimately, yeah. The most controversial characters.
Or aliens, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, or aliens in seats, I guess, yeah. If they do pay.
That's right.
You know, the most controversial characters are the ones who often attract the biggest crowds.
Yes.
Unfortunately, yeah. you need to pepper the good research with a little bit of crazy sometimes, I think. And that's unfortunate. It is unfortunate. MUFON had Corey Good speak at their symposium a couple years ago. So, it is what it is. You got to go a little crazy sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of controversy about that. I remember.
Yeah.
Someone on time travel as well too, I believe. I can't remember who that was.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you basically said, you know, one of the things we've never really talked about previously is, you said you also have an interest in ghosts and paranormal and stuff like that. Do you do a lot of writing on that topic as well?
As I was researching my book, it came up often in my research that a lot of individuals who study UFOs are also incredibly fascinated by ghost phenomena, psychic phenomena. They're interested in other odd paranormal events, monsters like Mothman, Bigfoot, that type of thing. And a lot of people who I spoke to believe that there's some sort of connection between all these phenomena. So UFOs are simply one aspect of a larger paranormal, I don't know, universe, let's say. It's a sort of grand universe of all things paranormal are connected, and UFOs are just one piece of that puzzle. So I have been doing a bit of research and writing into those fields. I really like actually the monster phenomena, right? So I guess we would call it cryptozoology, but I'm not necessarily sure if that's the right term. Only because I think cryptozoology deals with generally animals, things that are biological. And not paranormal in nature. So a cryptozoologist would say Bigfoot is an animal, just like any other animal. It might be intelligent, but it eats, it bleeds, and if you shoot it, it'll die. And then you can haul the body in and get $1 million for it.
I think it'd be worth more than that, actually. But anyway.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have this other branch of cryptozoology, which I'm kind of leery on calling it cryptozoology, but they're the ones who believe that Bigfoot isn't a physical creature. It can become physical, but it sort of is more paranormal in nature. It can kind of appear and disappear at random. It exists in our universe and then it doesn't, right? So a lot of those people also have interests in UFOs. So I've started to kind of deal with this idea a little bit. I'm not necessarily sure if I totally believe it yet. You know, I'm kind of, I'm willing to give it, you know, credence and credit and I'll think about it as a philosopher or as a theorist. I'm kind of compartmentalizing it into just, you know, it could be that, you never know. But I am interested by that stuff. I have to be honest, I was recently in Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Country, right?
Yeah, I was able to do a lot of research and interviews with Mothman witnesses and I went, you know, to the museum and did all that and met some interesting characters there. It's quite an interesting little piece of sort of UFO history as well, because John Keel really went in there and Gray Barker as well earlier, but talked about how there was a lot of UFO sightings connected with the Mothman case, and you had a lot of strange poltergeist activity and other sightings of other strange beings in the vicinity. So, you know, maybe there is something to be said for the connection between sort of all paranormal phenomena and UFOs. But then, you know, again, you kind of need to just kind of sit there in that I don't know camp. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But Mothman is such an interesting idea. And for me, it was incredibly compelling, because you have this this incredible connection between some sort of odd physical objective events that occurred. People saw stuff, or at least somebody saw something, and it started the Mothman craze in 66 and 67. So somebody saw something, right? Whatever it was, it could have been a bird, who knows? But somebody saw something. But now, you when you go to Point Pleasant, Mothman is everywhere. It's part of the fabric of that community.
Kind of like Roswell in a way.
It's identical. Yeah, it's identical. You know, they have a Mothman festival, and it brings in like something like 20,000 or 30,000 people come to that festival. So imagine this tiny little town, which is basically three streets. You know, has a population of like 1,200 people. Or something like that. Like, it's tiny. And then suddenly you jam like 30,000 people into it for a weekend. Apparently it's pandemonium, but apparently it's unbelievably amazing as well. So I do want to go.
Stay off the bridge.
Yeah, stay off the bridge. Yeah, especially. But you have this mix of mythology and reality forming, right? Some objective event occurred, and now you have this incredible myth that's built around the Mothman, and you're not sure where reality and mythology kind of, where it all begins and where it all ends, right? So it's become one sort of cohesive thing. It's such an interesting place to visit. Like, if you've never been to Point Pleasant and you're in West Virginia, you should go check it out. Because, I mean, I got to go to the old TNT factories. I went there at night, you know, walked around there at night, just kind of looking, you know, like doing crazy stuff that you know, I'm normally not able to do. So it was thoroughly enjoyable to have that fun. Unfortunately, I didn't see Mothman, but you get the feeling that sort of there's this reality for these people who live there that kind of keeps Mothman alive. And maybe that's what people see. Maybe it's people's kind of just need to have Mothman be part of the town that makes Mothman real, you know, whatever that means.
I know there were some sightings purportedly in Chicago in the last few years.
Yeah, in 2016. Actually, they started earlier, but they weren't really talked about. I know Allison Jornlin, who is she's in Milwaukee. She's a UFO investigator. She went to Chicago and did a bunch of investigating of those cases. And they started quite early on. I think they started in like 2013, she was saying, but it really took off. They had like a big flap, I suppose, of Mothman sightings in 2016. And it's actually in the new, if you know Seth Breedlove, who's Small Town Monsters, that's his studio. He's a great filmmaker. He does these great documentaries. He did one on Mothman, but his new one is coming out in June. It's called Terror in the Skies, and it talks about the 2016 Mothman cases. It's a great documentary. It's an interesting little, I don't know, the Mothman is such an interesting, I don't know, it's one of my favorite monster cases or cryptid cases. So, you know, you do see connections between UFOs and that, and people who are interested in UFOs investigate Mothman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
I know I had, I don't know if you've ever heard of Paul Eno before.
Paulino?
Yeah. He does a show on all kinds of things, UFOs, him and his son, Ben. Okay. And a good guy. He has kind of a theory of sort of the connection of everything, which is pretty fascinating. And I'm sort of paraphrasing what the idea of it is like there is a connection and everything. But I think he's thinking more, if I do have it right, he's thinking more of the interdimensional lines. You know, that's why we see ghosts. It's in another dimension, right, or, you know, out of a time step or something, you know.
Right. Yeah, well, it's very John Keel, right? That's kind of what John Keel kind of proposed, this interdimensional kind of paranormal system that kind of interferes with our dimension, I suppose. And, yeah, it manifests in different ways, which is why when people were seeing this flying humanoid, they were also seeing strange UFOs and the Men in Black and all these odd characters walking around their town. And they were seeing other creatures and they had like weird poltergeist activity. And I mean, you know, they blame the collapse of the bridge on this stuff, in the Silver Bridge. So, it's an interesting theory. I know that the people who investigate Skinwalker Ranch now sort of have a very similar idea, right? The Skinwalker Ranch is a sort of place where,
bring that up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where you have this kind of interdimensional force that sort of pops in and out. And it manifests in all these different ways, right? UFOs to weird monsters that crawl out of portals. And, so there is that kind of, I don't want to say it's a belief system because maybe that's not fair, but you do have this kind of discourse that occurs, where people sort of chase it more in that paranormal sense. So UFOs aren't aliens from space in sort of riveted together flying saucers. It's something else, right? And they just kind of appear as UFOs to us. That's what they've chosen to appear to us as, let's say, or Mothman or Bigfoot or ghosts or whatever. Yeah, it's a wild kind of... ufology is a wild ride, man.
It is. And then, you know, you get back to like the nuts and bolts sightings that are, you know, mass sightings and mass witnesses and all that. It really makes you have to pause and wonder, you know, exactly what we're seeing. And, you know, now that we see, you know, the government taking an interest, or at least allowing us to know that they have an interest in it, I think it's, you know, perhaps, and I've said this many times and I still believe it, I don't think they probably know too much more than anyone else.
Yeah, I agree. I say that in my book. The only kind of sane place to stand is in the I don't know. You know, you need to be open-minded enough to allow sort of a space for these things to exist in your mind, in the sense that, you know, people are claiming to see these things and there's enough evidence that supports, people do see weird stuff. And it's not necessarily, you know, stuff we make. But you also kind of need to remain critical enough and skeptical enough that, you know, your whole brain doesn't fall out and you believe every single thing anyone tells you. Because then you go down that weird rabbit hole of there's reptilians in Antarctica and, you know, there's, you know, blue avians walking around and mating with humans and making babies. You know, you kind of tend to go down that road. So you have to kind of remain in this middle ground. So the I don't know is kind of that good position to be in, I think.
Yeah. You know what? We lost, you know, Stan Freeman recently, and a big loss to the UFO field. But I remember his saying was, some UFOs are alien spacecraft. I mean, he really, really thought that was it. And I remember one time I had a conversation with him about it was a nice conversation about Leslie Kane, and he said, you know, sooner or later she'll get it and she'll actually say, you know, some aliens are involved. And, you know, I disagree with him. You know, I don't think that'll ever, that probably won't happen.
He was one of the last, I think, kind of nuts and bolts, you know, ET guys who did the conference circuit and was a full-time UFO researcher. You know, I'm not sure how many of those guys are left, right? Like, he was sort of that era, right? He was like a classic vintage, you know, UFO researcher. No one faulted him for that, because, I mean, ultimately he had some great compelling points. Sorry, my cat is like pushing on this table and he's massive. So when he moves, the whole damn thing,
the whole basement moves. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he was one of those, sort of classic UFO guys, he gave us a lot, I think, a foundation that we need to respect. A lot of his work is sort of really where a lot of my work hinges from, right? We needed to kind of go through his stuff, and you needed to read his work to have a good understanding of just the phenomenon in general. Now, we can agree or disagree if it's aliens or whatever. But yeah, he was one of those guys who was like, yeah, aliens from another planet in spaceships that they riveted together with bolts and flew here with weird technology. That was his jam. And it's a shame that he passed away.
A legend gone. You know, you were talking about researchers, and earlier you mentioned that there were, you had a film, I haven't seen it yet, that came out this week or last week, that are about three things that an investigator needs to have. Can you touch lightly on those or give a little spoiler to your clip there?
Yeah, sure. So my last YouTube video, was an interesting one. It did cause not a lot of controversy, but people did kind of comment. And so the video is about the three sort of secrets of UFO investigation. So anyone who wants to get into doing UFO research or UFO investigation, there's sort of three things you need to know before you do it. So the secret number one, and I won't go into too much detail because I don't want to spoil the video. You should go watch it. But, you know, number one is it's incredibly time-consuming work, and it's very dull and dry a lot of the time. You know, when I first joined MUFON, I got my MUFON ID, right? Like that, my little, like, I'm a field investigator card. And I was like, I got it in the mail and I thought this was the coolest thing in the world. And it really isn't. But being a nerd, I'm like, look at this thing. And my wife's like, you're such a loser. Like, that's what I'm like. You know, so I had my picture on it and I was, you know, I'm going to drive, you know, I'm ripping down the highway in my Toyota, right? I'm going to, like, you know, see this flying saucer crash into a field. I'm going to run in there and save the day and, like, flash my MUFON card and be like, it's okay, I'm here, you know? Like, that's what you think, you know?
You do look a bit like a very young J. Allen Hynek, really.
Oh, thanks very much. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah, it is.
So, you know, you have this impression that UFO investigation is exciting. And really fundamentally, it's not. It's really dry and boring. The only interesting part that I liked was meeting with witnesses. And you know, you meet a lot of interesting kooky people, but you meet a lot of interesting kooky people everywhere. So that's not weird. It's when you meet the people who impress you incredibly, because they're the most down to earth. Individuals you've ever met in your life, like salt of the earth, and they simply sit there and say, like, I don't know what the hell I just experienced or saw, and this is what I saw. I don't know what it was, but this is what I saw. And then they just kind of just tell you, and they don't talk about aliens, they don't talk about interdimensional beings, they're not engaged in UFO, in the UFO story whatsoever. They don't read about it. They just sort of say, like, something has disrupted my life, and I don't know what to do. And then you, as a UFO investigator, say, I don't know what to do either. But you take down their stories. And for me, that's what's the most interesting, is meeting these individuals and collecting their stories and kind of forming this picture of the culture and these individuals, the sort of these UFO people.
Speaking of that, that's the title of your book.
It is. It's somewhere. Yeah. It's up there. Here, I'll get it. Wait, I'll show it to the people at home.
Well, actually, I can't really flash it on YouTube. Unfortunately, they for trademark purposes, I've had. But anyway, let's just move on. But yeah, we can't really have the book up there.
Oh. All right. Well, then I won't show it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is the name of my book, UFO People: A Curious Culture. We'll get to that in a second because I'll quickly go through two and three of that video.
Okay.
You don't mind.
Yeah.
Secret two was you play a lot of politics, and nepotism is a huge aspect of UFO investigation, UFO research. It's not what you know, it's who you know half the time. And then secret number three is that you walk out of it not knowing a damn thing. Like, you don't learn anything that you didn't know before. You meet a lot of interesting people, you do a lot of research, but you fundamentally kind of go, well, I still don't know what UFOs are, and you have to throw your hands up and just kind of be fine with that. Because anyone who sits there and says, I know what UFOs are, like, I know what the source of the UFO phenomenon is, here's what it is, they're delusional, they're lying, or they're trying to sell you something, right? And that's really the God honest truth. So those are the three secrets of UFO investigation.
Well, I like it. And I totally get the fact that, you know, anytime I talk to someone that witnessed a UFO event, I think it's fascinating. You know, when you're face to face and they tell you, and I really like, I've had this happen probably 20 times since I've done the show, where I talk to someone that I consider outside of the circuit, outside of the field, outside of the interest, that had absolutely amazing sightings, and it comes up in conversation. Well, I had a sighting, and well, tell me about it. And then you hear this like crazy stuff that is just amazing, and I love that stuff. I love when that happens.
Yeah, I refer to this group as the silent majority. I've told the story a million times, but my wife will you know, we'll go to like a party, like a house party or, you know, a work party, and she'll let people know in various social circles that I wrote a book about UFOs. And you know, 30 people at the party, they all kind of look at you funny, like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And they're like, that's kind of strange. And they start talking about it with you. But you know, it kind of just stops there. Like they don't necessarily want to talk to you in public, but then all of a sudden, as the party goes on, you know, you're off getting a beer from the fridge and, you know, you find yourself in a room alone with someone. They're like, hey, you know, you're the UFO guy. Yeah. So my mom saw this, or my dad saw this, or my brother saw this, or I saw this. And suddenly you're in a party of 30 people and 27 or 28 of them have come to you one-on-one to tell you their story, that they know someone who had a weird experience, or they themselves had one, they saw something strange. And they're everywhere. Like, I think when you really, like, there's a lot of people who have experienced weird stuff. They just don't talk about it because they don't know who to talk to, and they feel weird about it. And they're not engaged in the UFO community. They're just not part of it. So to them, it's this weird little part of their life that they just don't want to talk about, until someone shows up and says, yeah, no, it's okay, you can talk to me about it because I wrote a book about it or whatever. Suddenly they just unload on you and they tell you the strangest stuff you've ever heard in your life. And these are people who, you know, don't watch anything UFO related. They don't even like science fiction, and, you know, they've had weird encounters. So there's definitely a silent majority out there of people.
I've actually been at you know, a conference where it was a show of hands, how many people thought they saw UFO, and then basically how many people reported it. And it was almost everyone, first of all, had a UFO. And you could also argue that, you know, people that have had a UFO sighting may go to a UFO conference. You know, that's probably related. But also just the fact that so few people report it and the lot. You know what I just thought of? I told you not to show your book, but go ahead and show it. And, you know, the reason why is, on this video behind you is a whole bunch of books, and you can see the cover of some of them. And just, you know, the reason I mentioned that is because I did get bumped off of YouTube for a short while because of I was having book covers as part of the thumbnail, and that's why they bumped me off. But go ahead, grab your book behind you and show it.
Yeah, I don't think they'll have a problem with this one. I'm also not going to sue you because it's my book, so don't worry.
Okay, we have that on tape. Yeah. There's the book for the people on YouTube, UFO people. Yeah.
So you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Book Depository, anywhere books are sold, basically, you can find it. So you just Google the UFO people, and there you go.
Is that Jay Allen on the cover?
It sure is, yeah.
Wow. I thought it was you at first. Wow.
Yeah. This is the famous Piedmont, Missouri photograph, which was taken by Ted Phillips in 1973. And actually, that's where I got the idea for the book title. So if you can't sort of see it, I'll kind of bring it closer. It says, Welcome, UFO People. When Hynek went down to Piedmont to investigate a UFO flap, the motel put up that on the billboard there, Welcome, UFO People, on their sign. So Ted Phillips, who was with him, and Ted Phillips was quite young then, snapped the photo of J. Allen Hynek standing in front of the sign. I was lucky enough to chat with Ted's wife, and unfortunately Ted is quite ill, so he wasn't able to talk to me, but his wife said that he thought the book was a great idea, and his picture should obviously sort of, he thought it should grace the cover of the book, so he gave me permission. So there's a big thank you in there to them
That's wonderful.
For allowing me to use that picture. But it's a classic, but it really encapsulates, I think, what the book's about, which is people who chase this phenomenon. You know, if you're interested in UFOs and you research them, you hunt them, or you investigate them, or you've encountered them, the book is really about that community of people, those individuals who are compelled for some reason to chase things that, you know, should not exist according to mainstream culture. So it's an interesting read. A lot of people have given me a lot of positive feedback about it. So, you know, it's been a relative success for a book. So I'm very happy about it.
Can you give some more detail on some of the things you explore in that?
Sure. There's the book kind of covers various segments of sort of the UFO population, I suppose. I deal with a handful of experiencers and their UFO sightings and their encounters, I suppose, which is interesting for experiences. But I think the most interesting part of the book was when I was able to meet with some of the more controversial and interesting people in the UFO community. Richard Doty gave me his time.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, and we spoke at length. He told me his side of the story, and
for the new listener that has no idea who Richard Doty is, and Paul Benowitz and all that. Go ahead.
Very briefly, the 1980s, there was an interesting encounter. A man named Paul Benowitz, who lived near Kirtland Air Force Base, was picking up some odd signals on some sort of radio system he had set up. He was investigated by the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. And Richard Doty was the agent, or one of the agents, rather, who was sent to investigate Benowitz. They realized he was listening to basically an early sort of satellite. I guess it was like a satellite communication system that used lasers to communicate with satellites, early satellites anyway. And they realized that Paul Benowitz was already kind of a little connected with the UFO thing. They told him it was aliens and he believed it. And he and Doty started sort of this relationship. And Doty will say they were friends. And I don't necessarily I don't disbelieve him. I think they were. But he kind of kept kind of feeding him this story that aliens were around and Kirtland Air Force Base was involved. And there was an underground base, I think, in somewhere in New Mexico, Dulce, New Mexico. And Paul Benowitz sort of at one point had a nervous breakdown because of all this. And since that moment, and since sort of the admission by another gentleman named William Moore, who was another UFO researcher who's sort of working with Doty. And anyway, it's a big historical schmozzle that I can't really get into. But Richard Doty kind of was painted as the villain of ufology. When I first said I was going to interview him, a friend of mine who's another UFO researcher said, you know, he's the most hated man in all of ufology. So he was an interesting person to talk to because he's very much a human being. People either hate him or they don't, and there's not many people in the middle. It's tough because, you know, a lot of our conversations didn't focus upon UFOs at all, but focused upon he has grandkids who are close to the same age of my kids. So we talked a lot about sort of having toddlers in your life. We talked a lot about food and beer, and just, you know, very human conversations. Mm-hmm. So that was really nice because he's just a guy. Like, he's just a guy who wants to talk about those things. He loves his grandkids and he loves beer and he loves good German food. So we had sort of these very human conversations, and then UFOs would come up, and then suddenly, you know, the tone would shift. Mm-hmm. And it would be a very different conversation. All of that, the nice, warm kind of human Richard Doty would sort of go away. And now you can tell that we're kind of now in this weird realm of UFOs, and he's very protective because obviously, you know, of what he's been painted to be, and partially through his fault and maybe not his fault as well, kind of a mix of both. Rick Doty was an interesting guy to talk to about UFOs, and there's some interesting kind of, I don't want to say new information, but weird information in the book about him that I don't think anyone's kind of ever seen or read before. Hopefully kind of people pick it up if they're interested in that story. I got to interview Christopher Green, Dr.
Before
Christopher
we move
Green.
On from that, I just wanted to mention something. Yeah, I have thought about having Richard on the show. I didn't know if it would make people angry or not. But, I know Alejandro has said, Alejandro, who helps out with UFO updates, has had a little bit of a beef about Richard Doty. So that's one of the things. But I saw him on the latest Stephen Greer documentary, and he was off the rails. I was really shocked. He was talking about alien beings and things.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand what that was about. If he did that for For what reason would he do something like that? Is that something that came up in your conversation?
It did. Yeah, it did. And I didn't include a lot of that in the book. I did to a point. Like I talked about it in the sense that this is what he said to me. But I didn't go in depth too much because, again, you're not always sure when it comes to UFOs. You're not always sure where you stand with Rick Doty. When he talks about, like I said, the human stuff, you know, it's easy. You get that, right? Clearly, this guy would die for his grandchildren and wouldn't think it twice. Like, he loves them with all of his heart. So he's a very human person. But then you don't know when he talks about UFOs where the lies and where the truth really exists. So he talks a lot about aliens and extraterrestrial beings and all that. Very kind of Linda Moulton Howe kind of EBEs from like Zeta Reticuli and the whole project, like Serpo thing. Like there's like he kind of goes into all that. And you're just not sure if he's just that's his story now because that's just the game he's playing, or if he honestly believes that. And you just can't tell. But like you're right, it does sound totally off the rails. Like he's talking about, you know, dead aliens and in bunkers and how, you know, we had agreements and one went back and like that, like the 1980s kind of tropey UFO stuff that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. And you're like, really? Like this, you honestly sit here and believe that stuff? And you know, he says that he saw some of this stuff and you're just like, okay, well, let's change the subject because we're not going to go anywhere with that, right? Because there's no way he can prove any of it. There's no evidence that he can provide. So you kind of get lost in that world with him sometimes.
I think, you know, the reason there's a lot of people don't like him is actually pretty valid myself. You know, I mean, I think of Paul Benowitz, and it was such a sad case. And I feel as though that he was instrumental in pushing him over the edge, you know.
I think Paul Benowitz was a little sort of, you know, he was kind of in that already. But I do agree. I think definitely Rick Doty did have a hand in that shove. But you know, we also have to, and it's so tough because I talk about this in the book. Paul Benowitz died in 2003. And he had a mental breakdown, I think, in 1989 or 88 or 89. But that mental breakdown isn't what killed him. What killed him was the fact that he smoked like 3 packs of cigarettes a day and he drank 2 liters of, or 2 liters, sorry, you don't have liters. Like he drank like, what are those big bottles? What do you call those big bottles in the United States?
The half like gallons.
Oh yeah, there you go. He drank like a half gallon of Pepsi a day. And I mean, that's what killed him. You know, it wasn't the whole alien thing. Cause after 89, he didn't touch aliens again, really. And that was not really part of his life. His family pulled him out of that world. He kind of died from other causes.
I never knew, you know, it sounded to me like he had some type of mysterious death or no one really knew exactly what happened. Some people speculated that he committed suicide and no one has it really come up with how Paul passed away. But you think that he died of causes due to health issues from smoking, basically?
Yeah. I thought it was relatively well known. I thought sort of Greg Bishop wrote about that in Project Beta. No, yeah, was that his book, Project? Greg Bishop's another author. Yes. I think it was called Project Beta.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, Paul Benowitz was not a healthy person by any means.
I know Chris Lambright did a lot of work.
Right. So, you know, we need to kind of be cautious. I'm not necessarily sure. And again, a lot of people blame Rick Doty for Benowitz's undoing. And I think Rick Doty did play a hand in Paul having his mental breakdown. But I don't think, you know, the man's life is on Rick Doty's hands. Like that blood's not on his hands. So, you know, I want to be cautious because I also want to give, you know, Rick Doty a fair shake. I want to kind of remain as journalistic as possible. But that doesn't mean that I absolve Rick Doty because again, I don't necessarily know when he was talking to me what was totally truthful and what wasn't. And what's interesting is Rick Doty, and I say this in the book, Rick Doty really kind of reflects the UFO community a little bit, right? This mix of truth and fiction, of honesty and fabrication, right? Because the UFO community is full of people who do very similar things. They lie outright about their sources. They lie outright about their information, only to garner attention, only to garner now views and clicks and subscriptions to their YouTube channels. Like this, no, I don't lie. I've got nothing to lie about. But they really do, right? Yeah. And we kind of dabble in this world of mythology and reality. And Rick Doty is a perfect example of this. He's almost like this personified version of myth and reality kind of mixed together into one person. And I think maybe that's why we don't like him. Maybe it's we look at Rick Doty and we sort of see ourselves. And, you know, you have that weird crisis, that epistemological, the existential crisis. And you're like, oh, crap, you know, that's me. Ah, and then you freak out. So, he's an interesting fellow, though. And you should have him on the show. I think you'd have an amazing show.
Well, we'll talk about that with his contact info after. I think I would do it. Okay, when I sort of stopped you there, you were starting to talk about, I thought you said the name Christopher or something.
Yeah.
You were going to continue on with about your book. Go ahead.
I think for the vast majority of people who read my book, they often point, I think it's chapter 10, which is titled The Invisible College. And I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Christopher Kit Green, Dr. Hal Puthoff, and Dr. Gary Nolan from Stanford University.
Yeah.
As well as a few other individuals who chose to sort of stay out of the book, at least publicly. They wanted to hang on to some anonymity, which I respect. But those three sort of put their names out there and said, yep, you can include this. And it was really interesting to talk to them because, for their respected, they hold, you know, academic degrees. They are successful professionals in their various fields. And you can't argue with that. You know, a lot of people will look at them and they'll look at people like Kit Green and Hal Puthoff and say they're spooks, and they're government disinformation agents and CIA and blah, blah, blah. And they're nuts. And like, they'll make all these ridiculous statements. But then when you talk to them and you meet with them and you sort of Skype with them and chat with them over the phone and, text them regularly, you realize they're very down to earth individuals. And all the stuff people say about them is just, it's just people talking, and it really bears no factual basis. Because at the end of the day, you can't argue with the fact that they're successful. You can't argue with the fact that they're well respected in their various fields. They have plenty of business. They're doing quite well financially, to the point where they run some of them multi-million-dollar labs that have government contracts. So fundamentally, you can't argue with that. And they live in an interesting world because they sort of sit in this kind of not elevated, but this kind of other realm of the UFO people because they have contacts in U.S. intelligence or military intelligence. They have contacts in private industry, Lockheed Martin, Sandia Labs, whatever. They have kind of these contacts with these people and these groups and these players who no one really knows. They don't attend conferences. They don't give lectures at UFO conferences, but they're incredibly interested in the UFO phenomenon for various reasons, whether it's financial reasons, spiritual reasons, just personal interest because they had an experience themselves. So I got to meet or I got to chat with these individuals, like I said, these three guys, and some others, but it was wildly fascinating, and the chapter is so interesting to read because it paints a great picture of the work they're doing and how they're using their science and their science backgrounds as well as their contacts to study UFOs. One thing, though, that's incredibly clear is they play their hands incredibly close to their chest. Like, they're not really interested in attending UFO conferences and sharing that information in the way sort of the UFO community disseminates information, right? They go for peer review and an academic process and a scientific process. But it's a great chapter because it, like I said, it kind of paints what their work is focused on right now and what they're up to, and their various studies, and some of it blows your mind because you sit there and you read it and you go, like, how is this real? Because mm-hmm. mainstream culture says none of this stuff exists. Yet you have incredibly talented scientists and thinkers actively engaged in studying UFOs, privately and quietly, invisibly. So I give you a bit of a sneak peek in the book, as much as they would let me anyway, which I think is you know, interesting anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've said many times on the show, and what is it going to take to have science take this seriously? And it is really, you know, refreshing to hear that, you know, some people in science do take this seriously and, you know, beyond just a mild interest and put their reputations on the line, basically. And I think that only breeds more. In other words, the more people are seen doing this, people in their field, the more people may take the chance and follow suit. And who knows, we may get some type of answer. I personally don't know if we'll ever know an answer. I've said this a couple of times on past shows, but I watched a great, I can't even remember what it was. I think it might have been on YouTube or something, but it was a documentary about UFOs in the 50s, sometime in the 1950s. And there was an old guy, and it was in black and white, and there was an old guy wearing a derby, and he said, I just hope in my lifetime I'm going to know what these things are. You know, and I think about, wow, that guy's been probably gone, you know, 40 years or something like that. And you know, I wonder, I feel almost like we're on the verge of knowing a little more. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, man. Well, I'm going to depress you, Martin, because I don't think we're going to know. You know, I've said it publicly, so I have to defend my statement. But I don't think that we're going to know what the source of the UFO phenomenon is, at least not in total. We might get some more clues and some more pieces. I think where we're at is we need to figure out what the right questions are to ask. Mm-hmm. I don't mm-hmm. think we're anywhere near answers yet, because right now we're not even asking the right questions.
We may not know the questions to ask.
Really. Exactly.
Yeah.
So once we start learning, once we start kind of piecing that together, what are the questions that we need to ask? Then we might start looking in the right direction. The problem is, what muddies all this is ideology. We get bogged down in our opinions and our beliefs as mm-hmm. to what the UFO phenomenon is, and it takes over. For some reason, we've allowed ourselves and we've allowed our discourse to just buy into stuff that's kind of ridiculous. There's no evidence really, apart from witness testimony, to support that reptilians exist, or you know, that there's creatures that live in Antarctica or whatever. Because there's no real evidence. There's just witness testimony. But people see a lot of weird stuff. People have seen elves and fairies and leprechauns and ghosts and Bigfoot and Mothmen. So like, what the hell is it? Reptilians are probably just part of something else, right? So I think that these are distractions. I think we're being, in part, the phenomenon is distracting us in some way, right? It's giving us these weird things that don't necessarily make sense. But the problem is we kind of start going down that road, and it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We kind of, you know, we kind of, it becomes very circular, and we start to kind of consume these ideas. And then they kind of consume us. And then all of a sudden we spend a whole bunch of time and a whole bunch of energy, you know, listening to people who talk about reptilians and how there are overlords and there's a galactic federation of all these alien races who are working together, or they hate each other and they're for some reason situated on the other side of the moon. And like, there's all this like stuff, right? Yeah. And you go like, where is this all coming from? Like, but again, I think it's just, we get lost in our beliefs. And we just perpetuate them. So there's a lot of distraction. We're not actually asking the right questions here. And we're wasting time, we're spinning wheels. But unfortunately, those are the people who bring a lot of attention to ufology from the outside, right? Everyone kind of starts wondering if there's reptilians or grays because that's what's on TV. And then all of a sudden you go down the rabbit hole and you do more research and you realize it might be a little more complicated than that. But it's like, you know, I don't know. So anyway, that's a long way to get to your answer, which I didn't really answer. So I'm going to stick with my, I don't think we're going to find out what UFOs sort of are anytime soon. I think we'll start getting closer to asking the right questions. I think we're going to find some more evidence. I think we're going to have skeptics start to change their minds a little bit, which will get that ball rolling. Mm-hmm. Right? Because ultimately the skeptical community is who you need to convince. You need to convince the people who don't believe that something strange might be going on. Because once you convince them, yeah, you're golden. So that's kind of where I think we're headed. I think the next 5 years is going to be a very interesting half decade for UFO research. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to kind of see a resurgence in a more scientific, a more critical approach to UFOs.
Yeah.
And I think what we're going to start to maybe see dissipate slowly, at least kind of become less popular, is a kind of more sort of wild, weird aspect of ufology. I think we're going to kind of, I think groups like the Scientific Coalition for Ufology,
yes,
and To the Stars to a point, and this whole, like, you know, unidentified series and all that, I think it's going to kind of start elevating the discourse a little bit. And I hope that that's sort of where we go in the next 5 years.
Yeah. 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 Well, I'm encouraged. I'm just encouraged that it just seems like an easier topic to speak about now than it was when I started this show. And I'm not so, you know, I mean, as far as my real job and my real career in the fine arts and all that, I'm not as nervous about someone finding out that I do a show on UFOs, because if someone Googles my name, you'll see two things, UFOs. Yeah. And fine art in fine art appraiser and antique appraiser. Those are the two things that come up. And so if someone, you know, a lot of people do check my background as far as doing appraisals, they're bound to see the UFO thing. I'm not so worried about it as I was, you know, when I first started this show.
Well, it's also because they've probably had an experience, because most people have.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people...
well, like, yeah, you said, it's not necessarily that person, but someone knows someone.
Exactly.
You know, that's what I always get. You know, like you said at a party, someone said, oh, my mother had this and that. And that's what I hear all the time.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I never saw anything, but my brother did. And he said it was totally, you know, unbelievable. I can't believe it. I think we're just about out of time here. We just got another minute or so. So go ahead, if you would, and tell people where to find you, your blog and your books and all that.
Sweet. Yeah, thanks very much. So the best way to find me is just Google. But I do have a website, mjbanias.com. And you just go there, and it just basically links to places where you can buy the book. It links to my YouTube channel. It links to my blog. So it's all available on mjbanias.com. But my blog is Terra Obscura, and that's www.terraobscura.net. And then my YouTube channel is just MJ Banias. You can just go to youtube.com/MJ Banias, and you'll see my picture there. And like I said, I release two videos a week there. My blog posts, usually I try to do one every week or two. And then I also write for Mysterious Universe, so you can see my articles there as well. So yeah, I'm kind of all over. I mean, Google is the best. Just Google, yeah, MJ Banias, and you'll find me. I'm all over social media as well. So
yeah,
feel free to shoot me a message. I love getting emails from people. I've been doing sort of a lot of different shows and stuff just because of the book. And I've had so many emails come in from people saying, you know, I enjoy this, I don't like this, which is fine. I'll take criticism.
Yeah.
But also just people telling me their stories. They've had this experience. And I love getting those emails because I love talking to people about their experiences and what they're interested in and what they're researching. I've made a lot of new friends as a result. So
yeah,
please hit me up and I'll be happy to talk.
Yeah, you're not a guy that rests on his laurels, that's for sure. You're a busy guy and always.
That?
Yeah, and with a family, too. Anyway, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
And Martin, thank you very much. This has been great.
Yeah, great. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah. All right, everyone. So that is it for our show today. And We are going to be coming back next week, as always. And I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show, and anyone can help out. And I want to mention next week, I have a great show with a guy that has written on UFOs. He's a university professor, Dr. Michael Masters. He'll be on next week. So everyone, again, thanks so much. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.